This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for joining us. For the past few weeks, we've been asking all of you, our listeners, to use your smartphones to record a few moments of your day and to share it with us, because we want to hear what your life sounds like. Well, this is what life sounds like the day after Hurricane Ida, when your family lives in New Orleans, but made the choice to evacuate.
So we're at Vincent's house here in Pelham, Alabama.
This is the voice of my mother-in-law, a fourth-generation New Orleanian. Now, she gave me permission to record our phone call on Monday, and ours was a conversation repeated with slight variations by tens of thousands of families on Monday when the raging winds of Category 4 Hurricane Ida finally slowed. And it's a conversation we've had after other storms. First, you ask about the family.
So my sister Iris is with her extended family. Corey and his wife and the kids and the mother-in-law and brother-in-law, they are all in Atlanta. I'm not sure what they're going to do because they planned on leaving on Wednesday. Dia and her kids went to Houston, but they're back, but they're going to find a place with electricity tonight to stay. Ava and her son Mike, they're in Houston, and Aunt May is in Columbus, Mississippi, so we're scattered all over.
Then you find out about the neighbors.
I guess there's a hole in the roof. And she's trying to get a blue tarp because she says the upstairs bedroom has a hole in it.
Only then do you inquire about the house and any damage it might have sustained.
My neighbor says that from what she could see, my house looks okay.
And eventually, when you're talking to New Orleanians, the deep-rooted, born at charity hospital kind, the ones whose first question when they meet a stranger is always, "Where'd you go to high school?" On the day after a storm, those New Orleanians will eventually begin to reminisce, sharing memories of other storms survived.
You know, we grew up in New Orleans. I can remember there was Hurricane Betsy, and there was another hurricane that was two hurricanes that were really bad when we were little, but people didn't really evacuate then, you know? I remember the hurricane when it came through and decimated the Lower Ninth Ward where my grandmother lived. And there was the one that came through. We were living in Rosemont Place. We didn't get any damage. We just didn't have electricity for a very long time, you know. But we had never evacuated before. It just never seemed, you know, just listening to it on TV, but we stayed.
The assumption of just staying, well, that all changed 16 years ago when Hurricane Katrina prompted my family to do what they'd never done before, evacuate.
We were just lucky we left for Katrina, you know. When we were listening to the weather, when the popular weatherman, Bob Breck, said, you know, his family was leaving, you know, Jim and I kind of looked at one another and said, well, you know what, the weatherman is leaving, you know. we better get out of here, too. We had, like, a convoy. It was, you know, James, Jason and Martha, a dog, Iris and her dog, my mom, Marshall.
And it's these memories of Hurricane Katrina and of all that was lost when the levees failed that kept so many of us far-flung children up late into the night as Hurricane Ida approached. August 29. I mean, that date is etched in New Orleanians' memories as surely as birthdays, anniversaries, and holidays. That Category 4 Hurricane Ida was threatening the city on August 29th. It was enough to tie our stomachs in knots and to prompt so many of our family members to evacuate. Fortunately, the levees held. Here's New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell.
It did not happen. We did not have another Katrina. And that's something, again, we should all be grateful for. However, the impact is absolutely significant. While we held the line, no doubt about that. Now is not the time for reentry.
But before it was downgraded to a tropical storm early Monday, the hurricane brought catastrophic flooding, high storm surges, and 150 mile per hour winds to low-lying coastal communities like New Orleans. The storm surge was powerful enough to temporarily reverse the flow of the Mississippi River. And most critically, Hurricane Ida toppled a transmission tower that provides electricity to New Orleans. The photos of the electrical tower lying in the river make it pretty clear just how long it's likely to be before the 1 million residents without power can once again light the darkness, cool their homes, or refrigerate their food. All of which leads me to ask the one question which proves I came to New Orleans' identity through marriage rather than birth. I actually asked my mother-in-law if this is enough. If facing a month-long evacuation or having to brave weeks without electricity finally is enough to make her and my father-in-law consider moving. Ultimately, it's a silly question. They're New Orleanians, and like any tree with deep roots and broad branches, New Orleanians do not transplant easily.
I think just this time, you know, just kind of thinking like, you know, this is really crazy, you know, thinking that people could live any place, you know, so that, you know, every year you don't have to sit and wonder, is this the year we're going to have to evacuate? But, I mean, you know, this is where we've been, you know, this is where our investments are. You know, we have a house, and normally New Orleans is a nice place to live. It's just hurricane season, you know, which seems to be more frequent lately to me.
Did y'all catch that? My brilliant, kind mother-in-law flipped that question about moving into a conversation about climate change. They're not going anywhere. Which means more hurricane seasons and more conversations that sound just like the one you just heard. Here to help us think about Hurricane Ida and what the storm means for the city of New Orleans is Sarah Gibbons, environment writer at National Geographic. Sarah recently wrote about how Ida could reshape New Orleans. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Melissa. Happy to be here.
And also with us is Oliver Lachlan, U.S. Southern Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Oliver, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
So, Oliver, I can hear that you're clearly joining us by phone. Can you tell us what you have seen on the ground there over the past 24 hours or so?
Sure, yeah. So I'm based in New Orleans for The Guardian and was here when Ida hit. It was an incredibly intense, pounding storm. I myself rode it out at home. I live in the French Quarter. My roof started leaking. We had some roof damage and wind damage as well. And have kind of been out in reporting in the city throughout the past 24 hours. A lot of people incredibly traumatized, obviously being reminded of what happened here 16 years ago to the day, which is when Katrina hit the city. A lot of people very thankful that obviously the levee protection system that has received a multi-billion dollar investment from the federal government over the years held, and there hasn't been substantial flooding. But now people really kind of coming to terms with, A, the damage to their own homes, and B, the fact that there is no power anywhere in the city, which is obviously having already a devastating impact on people's lives.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a bit. I think, you know, for folks who have maybe experienced a power outage for 24 hours, maybe even for 2 or 3 days, you have a sense of sort of why it's irritating or annoying. But talk to us a little bit about what this may mean for the city to be without power for weeks on end.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of unfolding and people are just kind of starting to grapple with the fact that that's a real possibility. For me, myself, I am struggling to kind of file updates and stories to my news desk. You know, obviously it's much more acute in communities around the city. So, you know, I spent some time out on the West Bank and people who were kind of hit hardest by the storm now kind of grappling with the fact that maybe they didn't bring in enough food to prepare for the next few weeks. Not really sort of comprehending the fact that, you know, long-term power outages could have been a possibility. And so people are looking to whether they can evacuate. Some people simply don't have the means to do that at the moment. And so, you know, kind of sitting around in humid homes, incredibly hot and humid here, as you know, and really just kind of trying to figure out what to do next. It's a very difficult situation and obviously difficult in different ways in many different communities here.
Sarah, I want to bring you in here because as Oliver's talking about sort of maybe not having brought in enough food and all of that, I always try to emphasize to folks when we talk about Hurricane Katrina that it did matter that it hit on the 29th, which of course is also now true of Ida. Too late in the month if you receive a check at the start of the month, but not late enough if your you know, monthly check comes on the last day of the month. Like the 29th is genuinely a disastrous day for disaster to hit for folks who are living paycheck to paycheck, which is a lot of working people. Can you talk to us a little bit about other ways that what we're seeing in Ida is a return to the experiences of Katrina, even with the levees, thank God, holding.
Yeah, I mean, I'll also point out, too, that this storm spun up so much more quickly than Katrina. People were really caught off guard and had only just a few days to try to prepare for this storm. In a lot of ways, you know, you mentioned the levee system that held, thankfully, after this storm. But Ida is exposing that the electrical infrastructure of the city still needs a lot of work. And so there's still a lot of ways that the city needs to adapt to these really dangerous storms.
And my mother-in-law said, Sarah, that she feels like hurricane season is now longer than when she grew up there or when her parents grew up there, that it's more intense. Is that borne out by the data?
We're not necessarily seeing more hurricanes in sort of the official tally or lengthening of the season. But, you know, with warming atmospheres and the warming ocean, we are seeing more major hurricanes, these category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast. You know, last year, Southwest Louisiana saw 2 major hurricanes back to back, Laura and Hurricane Delta. And so these storms, when they do manage to form, are growing a lot stronger than they may have in the past.
Oliver, I'm thinking about the saying that, you know, in military strategy, that we're always fighting the last war. And it certainly felt, just in my own social media feeds, as I was following friends and family who were making decisions about whether or not to leave, that we were preparing for the last hurricane, or not actually not the last one, but the big girl back 15 years ago, Hurricane Katrina, that the worry was about levee failure, but not about electrical failure.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a very difficult decision for a lot of people whether to go or stay. A lot of people I spoke who stayed behind this time are people who actually evacuated during Katrina. And as Sarah mentioned, for a lot of people, that choice was basically taken away from them by the fact that this storm formed so quickly. You know, it came out as a tropical depression on Thursday and basically was here by Saturday evening, which is really not a huge amount of time. One guy I spoke to in the lower ninth ward who had evacuated during Katrina said he was kind of watching news reports, basically, you know, 12 hours before, watching the category go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. So people basically, in many instances, just had the choice taken away from them. They weren't sure what to do. And by the time that they had decided they were going to evacuate, it was basically too late. It was gridlock on the highways, no way of getting out. So they had to batten down the state.
Sarah, I'm wondering about the ways that this experience, which is really just beginning in many ways in New Orleans, because now we're looking at weeks without power, might shape the city, might shape questions about the size of the population and also the composition of the population.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to point out, too, that New Orleans for the past 18, 19 months has really been struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic. They've seen unemployment rates as high as 15% in certain times of year, because this is a largely tourist-based economy that the city has. And so it's been really hit hard by COVID. They're going to be trying to recover at a lower point than they might have if they hadn't seen COVID-19 cases recently spiking. After Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the city lost about half its population. That didn't hit equally either. You know, before Katrina, you had 2/3 of the city's residents were Black. Now it was about half before Ida. And so whether or not the city will be able to continue regaining some of its population that it was starting to recover since Katrina, I think before Ida, it was a little over 300,000, remains to be seen. If those improvements will be made.
Right. And it's worth pointing out that when you lose population, you lose tax revenue, which makes it harder, right? It's hard to maintain city infrastructure for 700,000 people or 500,000 people if only 300,000 people live there and pay into the property taxes.
Absolutely. And it also has an impact on businesses. My colleague, Laura Parker, spoke with Allison Plyer from the data center in New Orleans, and she described this sort of chicken or the egg problem. You know, you have you need people to return so that the Home Depot opens, but you also need the Home Depot to be open so that people can return and begin to rebuild their homes. And so which one comes first is a sort of waiting game for a lot of people.
Oliver, as you have talked to folks, so, you know, I talked to my mother-in-law, she's evacuated at the time, but it's pretty clear that despite, you know, being senior citizens, she and my father-in-law will be returning. They will be working to address and rebuild in whatever ways they have to. As you've talked to folks who are there in the city, are there people who are talking not just about evacuating, but potentially departing in a more long-term sense?
I haven't spoken to anybody who's been talking about departing in a long-term sense, but there was a sort of clear feeling in some of these communities I was speaking to in the West Bank that the next hurricane that comes along, they're not going to try and wait it out. It's just too traumatic of an experience to sit through having your house pounded by wind and rain, to lose your roof, to worry that you're going to die. And so I think for a lot of people, this was potentially a turning point. And as Sarah mentioned, you know, these intense category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes are getting more frequent due to the climate crisis. And, you know, one of the key factors contributing to that in New Orleans is obviously coastal erosion that's happening. That was some sort of protection for the city, but as more and more of the coast gets eroded, that protection is being lost, rising temperatures as well. So I think whether people are conscious and linking that to the climate crisis themselves, I think they are, irrespective of that, saying this is just not something that we want to sit around and wait out any longer. You know, the next time one of these comes along, we're going to evacuate as soon as we hear about it. And that to me felt like quite a marked shift.
So Oliver, I'm not surprised to hear that New Orleanians are not talking about departing long term, but there is this other set of decision makers, businesses, and industry. And so again, already it is mostly a tourist area, one that has lost so much business as a result of COVID and having, you know, responsibly to close many of the festivals that bring in tourists. Have you heard sort of any talk of, on the economic side, about the possibility that folks who are, you know, the Home Depot, basically, you know, in the broadest sense, might not be returning?
It's very difficult for me to kind of update information about this sort of stuff, and I'm just because I don't have power as well. But what I can do is kind of refer back to what has happened over the COVID pandemic. I've been very anecdotally, like, you know, a number of businesses near where I live, which is a kind of tourist hub, closed down and not reopen. And, you know, again, in kind of conversations with friends who work in that industry, people observing that they have a lack of staff and inability to hire people. And so, you know, this is going on as the pandemic is still ripping through this region. You know, there's low vaccination rates in Louisiana, Mississippi. Hospitals were an all-time high just a couple of weeks ago. Really, we're not just talking about the effects of a hurricane. We're talking about, you know, a year and a half of sustained economic downturn due to the pandemic. So it's incredibly worrying.
Sarah, I'm wondering about lessons that could be learned from Puerto Rico and the months and months without power after Hurricane Maria. Are there things that we can learn about what went wrong there, about the federal government's response, about local response that could maybe go better in this post-Ida moment in New Orleans?
Yeah, I think the longer we wait to address some of these disasters, the worse they're going to become. You know, in a lot of ways, New Orleans suffered after Hurricane Katrina for a really long time. But in a number of ways, the city also improved as well. The school system before Hurricane Katrina hit in New Orleans was immensely struggling. After Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of investment made and a lot of improvements. Of course, it hasn't been made perfect, but it's significantly better than it was before. So the longer people are left without jobs, without infrastructure, and without their homes, the worse these types of disasters tend to become.
Sarah, I might have to have you back. We could have a little fight about the post-Katrina public schools and the question of what happened there. But it's a good point about the question of investment and also of community building. And certainly the post-Katrina schools are one thing. And I'm realizing we will be facing the post-Ida schools because kids can't go to school without power. And it's, again, after a whole year of remote learning from COVID. So Sarah Gibbons is an environment writer at National Geographic, and Oliver Lachlan is the U.S. Southern Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Sarah, Oliver, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.